I hear you now.
Perfect.
Okay.
Welcome to the Lighthouse Conversations. I'm Hashim Montasser, speaking to you from my home in Dubai. Today, I'm joined on the show by Nelio Leone, founder and CEO of Urban Monks, a growth marketing agency based here in Dubai. Before setting up his own company, Nelio has worked as a marketing manager at L'Oréal in Paris, and then he became director of brand at Careem, one of the region's few unicorn companies that was bought by Uber last year for over $3 billion. I've had the opportunity to work with Nelio as he did some work for us at the Lighthouse, and I was very interested in his approach to marketing, which seemed analytical and bespoke, and a nice departure, frankly, from the more cookie-cutter approach you encounter in many cases. I caught up with Nelio last week. It was his birthday, incidentally, to learn more about what he's been up to and how his company is making strides in their endeavor to become a marketing powerhouse.
I want to start with something interesting. I was doing some research on you and on your background, and I found something very captivating. A lot of people talk about Google and Facebook being obviously these big behemoths that, you know, are duopoly and really know everything about us. And I learned from you that our grandmothers, specifically Italian grandmothers, seem to know even more. Can you tell us a little bit about this? I'm curious whether this is your grandmother or we should all watch out and be very, very careful going forward with our grandmother.
So I guess you're talking about the TED Talk on the data privacy that that happened, I think this November. And yeah, I mean, it's really funny because it's true that at least in the southern part of Italy, which I think is pretty much everywhere in the Mediterranean, you always have like those grannies and those aunts and those aunties that would know everything about you because they've been like following you from their balcony since you're like, you know, 3 years old, and they never lost track of you. So I think that's the real weapon of mass surveillance.
There go, you know, Google and Facebook and these guys, and they're spending billions. And all they have to do is go to the southern part of Italy or anywhere really, and just ask to talk to the nonnas.
That's it. And just, you know, just pretty much record all the data about you and talk to your grandmother.
That's brilliant. And I think it's very true. And I mean, you had said in that TED Talk that you, at the beginning, were, like many of us, frankly, somewhat dismissive of data privacy issues. And then you did kind of a 180-degree turn. Tell us a little bit about this and what prompted the change.
Of course. And honestly, thank you very much for asking, because I think, you know, if there's one thing that really worries me after this COVID is really all the awareness about data privacy. And so I'll just give you an example. I think so. How the story really changed. So I was into marketing and growth for startups. I was working at a friend startup here in Dubai called The Washman. I was the head of growth, and basically what we managed to do at Washman, we grew it by almost like 7x in 14 months. And we started playing around with a lot of like customer data. And the way we played around, we started like really getting strings and strings of data, analyze it, cluster it, and then send a super targeted message for a very specific cluster of users. And when we then had this whole, you know, in 2017, after the Cambridge Analytica scandal, there was like this huge debate. California started to implement the California Act of Privacy. In Europe, we had the GDPR. And so as, you know, as digital marketers, we started like all kind of like, or growth hackers or growth marketers, we all started like really being kind of anxious on, okay, is our job, like, are we ever going to be able to do our job the same way we were doing before? Because with all these restrictions on privacy, and I was the first one of saying like, man, this whole thing doesn't make sense. The time when you start getting in on Facebook or you start having a digital presence, well, you're going to leave digital footprints everywhere. So don't expect, and these all services are great, they're free, but of course there's a cost for it. And it's when you accept those terms and conditions, well, it's all your privacy, and that it comes at the expense of a privacy. Otherwise, these could not ever be free. And this happened when I went to Africa for a project in Kenya. And I really saw what are the implications of living in a society that where privacy regulations are like, there's no protection for users and privacy regulations. So in Kenya, there are companies that actually, where you can pretty much get through an app, you can start having an instant loan. And by instant loan, it's like super small credit of like $20, let's say, just to, you know, just to spot you during the weekend. But then when you accept the terms and conditions, not only you accept some interest rates that are like 250%, 230%, basically you start spiraling into a debt trap. It becomes horrible because then people start gambling to then offset their loans. And you see also like suicide rates for like $40 or to up to like $140. People kill themselves because then they start to spiral in this debt. And what's really horrible about data privacy is that when you accept the terms and conditions, not only you accept these interest rates that are like, you know, they are what they are, but because there is no data regulation and data privacy, companies can mine your phone and can start sending to all your contacts through SMS or through WhatsApp messages saying that, hey, Ashton has a loan with us, help him, or we're going to pursue legal actions against him. So imagine in which situation you're put now. That really triggered so much like reflection on what really data privacy means. And from there, that's where I really took this as a wake up moment, as a wake up call to be very mindful on how we treat data, how we protect ourselves from data scraping and all of that, and how we create a society where things don't turn out to be an episode of Black Mirror.
Yeah, but there's no easy solutions, right? I'm aware of a company, friends of mine that went to school with me, started a company out of California called Ascent. And one of the things they do is essentially try to protect they develop tools to protect their data. And what happened is, interestingly enough, they wind up offering their services more to other companies. So it became a B2B. And again, and I want to kind of put this in perspective to the work you do, because ultimately as a marketer, right, I'm simplifying here a bit, but the job is to help companies like ourselves, for example, if I would come to you, find your target audience and connect with them and get to know them as much as possible. So the question is, you know, what's that fine line? Is getting to know them just having their email address, or is it, you know, stalking them on Instagram to figure out their habits so I can sell them more stuff? You know, I mean, who sets that line?
So I've been thinking this about a lot, and my perspective comes down to one thing. It should be in our power as users to be knowledgeable about what kind of data we're sharing. Today, when you accept the terms and conditions of different social media apps or whatever that is, you don't really know what kind of data they're sharing. So basically, I have no visibility. We have no visibility on what we're sharing and what we're not sharing. We have no visibility if companies start tracking your political views, if they can cluster you into a political bias. And if tomorrow there's like a major, political agenda of someone, and then you fall into that category, then you're not safe anymore. And same thing with sexual orientation, same thing with racial things. So, yeah. There's like so many different things that they become very tricky. So what I'm saying is that at the moment, there's a complete lack of transparency in what kind of data big companies have on us. And this, I think, it's a bit of a dark age of data privacy. And I think it's going to come soon to an end.
So just as a very basic Anelio exercise, what can individuals do? I mean, do I turn off my settings of geolocating, but then I can't use Google Maps? You know, do I turn off entering new apps via Facebook or Google? Well, but then it takes 5 clicks extra. So if I would come to you as someone who's obviously quite involved in that medium, what would you advise as kind of a basic way to safeguard our privacy without, frankly, making our online interaction extremely difficult?
And then, you know, there's Noah Yuval Harari, the guy that wrote Sapiens and then wrote 10 Lessons for the 21st Century. And it's exactly the same kind of thing that he pointed out. To which extent then we balance the trade-off between, being completely off the grid and your data privacy super secure, it's not a solution. But at least, you know, what's really like, what I realized during this project and after reading and really deep diving into the subject is at least to know and to have that curiosity to know what kind of data you're really sharing. And then once at least you're aware of what you're sharing and you can read those terms and conditions in diagonal to the extent where you can spot where what kind of things you agree to and you do not agree to, then at least it's already a small step forward and starts by educating yourself. And then slowly also the product will change. So the solution, there's no short-term solution today. There's an increasing incremental step that comes to education.
So you're saying at the very least right now, what we can do as consumers is being educated about what's out there in terms of our stuff online and how we can safeguard it.
Exactly. Okay. And I think, you know, at some point, and we were discussing this with a collective of growth hackers, a growth practitioner, that probably like the best thing to do would be to have a way to simplify those terms and conditions to really make people simply more aware.
Yeah, of course. So, they do it so that it's kind of buried, essentially. It's like, you know, a smart lawyer that's trying to make you sign a prenup or something, and you realize you gave away half your life, but you weren't aware of it.
Exactly. And I think that comes a lot through legislation, that there should be at some point regulation on digital products, that for any terms and conditions that you accept, there has to be like a short summary of 4 or 5 key bullet points on all the top burning topics, meaning what kind of personal things are, because it has to be super easy that when I open those terms and conditions, I'm not going to stay there and read like, 10 pages document that I'll never read.
Now, we haven't planned this, but the day after our conversation, Apple announced exactly that. An easy-to-read highlights page about an app or website's privacy policy featured along with descriptions in the App Store come September. I want to move to a related subject, Nelio. I mean, you call yourself a growth hacker, and growth hacking is obviously a growing and thriving community. Really, and that's something I fundamentally really believe in, and I have tried to use it in my career, especially over the last 5 to 6 years, that everything meaningful takes a really long time. You know, so things take time to be built, to be done properly, and one should enjoy that and in fact embrace it. So I'm going to just push back here a little bit and say, isn't growth hacking almost go kind of exactly to the opposite of that, in the sense that everything that is online and that is sort of today celebrated, many of those are, let's get there and get there fast. You know, if I have one user, I should be in 10,000, then 1 million within 3 months. How can I get there? I mean, isn't there something lost there in that process?
Yeah, and I agree with you. And that's why, you know, I don't like the term growth hacker or growth hacking. It's because it's prone to confusion compared to the initial way that it was really meant. So growth hacking comes from a book of Sean. And since nobody has ever thought of that process before, Sean Ellis came with this term growth hacking. That doesn't necessarily mean a shortcut to growth, but it means like going into the detail of what the signals, what the early signals of your product are telling you. And then you develop like an iterative strategy on very small data signal. So simply that your whole strategy is more data informed, and it's a faster way to go to product market fit versus when back then it was coined, there was still like the old way of doing marketing where you do a business plan of like 12 months and you spend like $1 million and then you open the gates and there's no customers. And so we were like, so that's why growth hacking came in. That is a very lean way to just take small data signals and then build on top of those small data signals. So that's why the term with time, it became a bit, not abused, but it became a bit like, oh, let's hack it. Let's like, but yeah, you can't honestly like to build something great. There's like, you can't really hack it. There's no way to hack such a complex phenomenon like growth?
I mean, you talk a little bit about this, and I was reading one of your articles. I'm going to simplify here, but you were saying build your audience, but don't sell. And I think it's an interesting point because, of course, we are all selling. I'm talking from a company perspective, something. But there's a way to connect with your audience where it does feel, I don't want to use the word authentic because I think it's highly overused, but, you know, genuine, where that connection is built first, as opposed to like, I have the data, bam, let me hit him now with a product. People, especially right now, perhaps post-COVID, browsing a lot, maybe not in the mood to be buying as much. So this creates a very interesting platform for many companies because you have larger online base that wants to see stuff, wants to consume, but perhaps don't hit him so hard. Did I understand that right?
Yeah, and exactly. So it all really goes down to one thing. Give first. Give value first. So what I'm just saying is that when you're building an audience, what you're doing is simply you're giving value to the user. Then it's not like an immediate return for you right now, but you're giving them value before you get value.
Can you give us, just for the sake of the audience, some specific examples of giving value?
Yeah, definitely. So let's say, for instance, if you have if you have your own business, like the Lighthouse. The Lighthouse is an amazing social lounge, very creative place here in Dubai. Imagine, so right now what you're doing with your podcast is not necessarily for people to buy, but you're giving value to that same community that you want to serve. This is just a very, very simple example. And you can do this at a small scale like we're doing here, but then you can do it as well like a huge scale, like with million and million and million of people. I can tell you something. For instance, take one company like Huda Beauty, okay? Huda Beauty, Huda didn't start monetizing her audience for years and years and years. And she started monetizing like very late in the process. So before it was not even a company, all she was doing, she was just taking like, you know, videos of herself, you know, answering very important questions that a lot of female out there were asking themselves. And she was giving like a very, she was giving value before she would actually take value.
Sure.
She was giving her expertise as a makeup artist before she could actually take money from those people she was giving value to. And these are the companies that I believe right now, they're very modern. And these are the company that, you know, that in general I see that, you know, have a great span in front of them, simply because they're there for something that is much deeper than a transaction. They're there for like a meaning and for a purpose. Because otherwise, if you don't have that purpose going on and that purpose that you give to the community, you can't go like 5 years or 3 years or 2 years without necessarily monetizing that audience just because you want to give. So I feel this is where really the most beautiful companies are people like these are companies that build a community before necessarily monetizing that community of users or whatever that is.
That makes a lot of sense. And this gets us to some of your current work. I mean, you know, and we had the pleasure to work with you for some time at the Lighthouse. And I found working with you, honestly, extremely inspiring. And I'm not just saying that because I have you here.
Thank you.
Mostly for the reason that the work felt more of a give and take and not as simply just sort of, you know, Nelio, I have this problem. Although we did. I mean, we were trying to figure out some of our growth funnels, if you will, especially how do we convert kind of an online, offline channel, because the Lighthouse has both a physical space, the restaurant and store, and also a very active online presence. And we were trying to create this online, offline efficient tool. And you helped us a lot with recognizing how to do that. One of the interesting things I found working with you was that you didn't simply just sort of, and you could have said, you know what, Hash, give it to me. I'm going to build it for you or help you or create the tools. But you actually try to pass on that knowledge to us. So that during that period when we worked together, we came out of it with building blocks that frankly helped us over and above that period when we worked with you, which I found personally, someone who doesn't have a digital marketing background, very, very powerful and very useful. And that is obviously at the core of what you're doing currently. So you have your own agency, or for lack of a better word, where you help companies that want to grow digitally. Right? Now, what is there a specific angle you are going for here? Because I think it's not a secret to say that a lot of companies, I can only speak about the Middle East and certainly about Dubai, are frustrated with the services they're getting. You have companies that are traditionally PR companies. I don't want to be mean, but I'm going to use the word masquerading as digital agencies, whereas really their knowledge is kind of old school, nothing wrong with that, but old school, more traditional PR. And then you have a bunch of companies trying to do it purely digitally, but a lot of them really not having that kind of knowledge. So I'm sure you see this far more than us, and you understand that there is an opportunity for a company like yours. But what are you bringing to the table that's new and that's fresh that would let someone like ourselves or anyone else come and work with you?
Yeah, so this is a very good question. And, you know, it really goes back to the purpose of why I started this agency, consultancy agency of growth that called Urban Monks. It's basically, it really started from one thing, is that when I was a marketing director, I started working with agencies, and what I really saw was I couldn't really find the right fit for us. To be honest, I was really motivated in creating the first boutique agency with one passion, that is passion of like really doing some edgy and very qualitative work. Mm. So that's why the way we operate. So we operate as a collective of now we're like in total 15 individuals, and we work as a collective. And all we do is like we scout very interesting projects to work with, and then we put them on the table, and we bring like different experts based on the different expertise, and we work as a community to problem solve it like it was a Lego.
So just to understand, so these 15, you are kind of loosely associated. This is not all part of one company.
So they're all part of Urban Monks, we call them the monks. But all of them are top growth professionals that come from vetted communities.
So it's a collection of freelancers essentially that work together.
Yes, it's a collection of freelancers that work together as a service agency. It's basically the difference, like a single plumber and then a contractor company. And Urban Sure. Monks functions as a contractor's company. So we collect the best growth professionals, and then we find the challenges that we're excited to solve and okay. to give really that quality of work up there. Because what we really super motivated and what really like the real passion is basically creating something that is very edgy and that we can push out the edgiest forms of marketing out there with digital channels. And it's the same as if you think of, let's say, architectural boutique company. Basically, you can find tons of them. And you can find very cheap, you can find super expensive. What we think is like we are sort of boutique growth architects of the best growth architects out there that want to build the craziest and play with all these digital tools at our disposal to really solve exciting challenges that come in terms of marketing.
And give us some example of what do these guys do. So like, if I give you a project today and you put five of these guys on my project or girls, what are their five? Like one does what? Performance marketing, one does what? I mean, give me some specific examples.
Sure, of course. So let's say, for instance, the first thing that we would do. So there's always growth architect. So that would really strategize the full engine. So how do you map out that growth engine to understand really when a user touches your brand, how he gets retouched again. And once you get touched once, then you get dragged into like a maze of really amazing things that touches you in terms of marketing. So once you see one ad, then you want to understand more, then you get touched with content, then we get touched through email. So that really multi-channel approach. Then we would go and find the different experts in those different side of the engine. So in order to increase the reach and to really go increase the reach and then increase conversion, we go to like the top of the best of performance marketing people. And I was shocked because sometimes, you know, I would call and say like, I'm sorry, it's really late in Australia where you live. I said, no, this is my happy place. This problem, I'm like, I really want to solve this. And then we go into also the creative aspect. So we work with the really super cool creative individuals, creative designers that are in the States, and they that are really passionate about their craft. So what we're really looking is for all these individuals that want to turn their craft and elevate it into art. We want to elevate marketing, not only in terms of results, but also in terms of the deliverable itself. And on top of that, as an agency, quote unquote agency, we also provide that learning experience for our clients if they're interested. Like you said, we would never go to a meeting of just saying, oh, this is our status update. And this is, no, we are going there because we really want you to get out of that as if you were like, you know, you've seen something so new and so, and that you've learned something that you're actually excited to, and you're looking forward to your next meeting with us. So it's not just like, oh, let's get status update and we're going to do this. No, during these calls, you learn with us because we're going to share all the key learnings and we're going to digest it and put it to you so that you elevate as well yourself. And then even when you're not working with us anymore, you still have those building blocks.
On average, how long is that period? So from beginning, on average, when you work with a company on such a project, what's the typical time frame?
So we've been around now for like 1 year and 4 months. And we've had clients since we opened, you know, since I started at the beginning as my own freelancer. And then I started really venturing out and building that sort of creative cloud. And so since then, we have like two clients that stayed with us since the beginning. And then the average, I would say, is like six to seven months.
Okay. And does it start with a few months and then grow? Or is it from the beginning that you kind of know, like, this is how long it's going to take?
From the beginning, in general, we know how long it's going to take. So in general, we start with the first phase of the project. And in general, it's like 3 to 4 months. And then we generally do it in two phases. So the first one is really we do the strategy, the implementation. And then the second phase is what we call the scale-up phase. It's where really we blitz scale, where we turn the engine to like 60%. And then clients that stay with us longer then are going to see that engine going faster and faster because it's a sort of diesel. You can't start like your growth engine. It's not like 100% capacity and capability from day one. You need to warm it up and then just like see it grow.
Yeah. And where do you rate us as a region, specifically, let's say Dubai and the UAE, in terms of, let's call it, digital sophistication? So from 1 to 10, if the US is probably close to a 10 in terms of product sophistication, knowledge, where would you rate this part of the world?
Well, it's a very interesting question because I think there's two different aspects, right? When we're talking about digital sophistication. And one is really the ability to, so there's the technical aspect. I think in terms of technical aspect, you see some very good talents out here, especially because in terms of technicalities, you have neighboring India where that have like amazing engineers and amazing, amazing digital practitioners because they're very advanced in their craft. The biggest challenge that I find here is really that sweet spot between technicality and creativity. This is what here is really missing in this region. At the end of the day, especially with all the work that we're doing at Urban Monks, is not to become like we would never claim to be the most technical digital agency out here. And we're not the most creative one because there's like the creative industry here is a bit it's a bit difficult. In the US, for instance, you'll see like a lot like Wellington Media, and there's like so many different media agencies that really captured so well that internet intersection between being very creative and very technical.
Mm. I agree with that. I think that is when I look at our work at the Lighthouse or other projects I work on, that is typically what's lacking. I agree with you. So when we look today, for example, on our online presence, we want to create really good quality product, which means someone that's very good at creating content, interesting design, really captive quality product, but then you also need that growth engine and the technical aspects of how do I disseminate this product once I have it. And we found exactly to your point that with people who've reached out to, whether it's agencies or individuals, freelancers, they have one or the other. So we have people that were maybe very good at helping us in content creation, people that were very good at helping us with potentially marketing or performance marketing, but not the two. And I think if you at Urban Monks are able to have a loose collective of individuals that provide both services to clients and really go deep and understand the client's needs, I think you have potentially gold mine in your hands.
Yeah, and this is exactly, and this is the exact positioning that we're constantly fighting. And I mean, right now we're still kind of early stages because it's been like 1 year. But we, like in 1 year, we already had that super strong product market fit, because by combining that creative element with that super technical element as well, we've seen some work that we really believe these are case studies. And I can tell you, in the first year of business, like in this first phase of Urban Monks, it's more, again, more about giving value than taking value, because what we do is like we're collecting case studies. And now I think we've got 7 solid case studies, and our North Star metric is to get to 10 to 12 really kick-ass case studies. And this is, and because we want to prove that point that technical and beautiful can come together. So what's our motto is a sort of like creativity that converts into sales or into something.
And what makes you tick? If you look at 3, 4, 5 years from now, I mean, are you looking to be the largest player in the region? Are you looking to be on every, I was going to say magazine cover, but magazines don't exist anymore. So maybe every website, a landing page. Are you looking to be fabulously rich and live off a yacht? All of the above, because that's every entrepreneur and every founder is really motivated, I find, by a series of quite unique personal circumstances that make them wake up in the morning and, despite frankly the shit that hits them sometimes, still go on. So what makes you keep going, and where do you see this going?
What keeps me going? So again, what really excites me is the, I'll be very honest, like what really excites me,
please,
at least right now in this moment, is the amount of learning. Because working with having that freedom of selecting the people you can work with, it's a privilege. I've been employee my whole life, and I couldn't really choose who my colleagues were, who I needed to report to someone, and you don't really have a choice. Right now, it's amazing, because with working with the other Urban Monks, on every call, I'm with someone that I really look up to. And that before, I would pay $5,000 a month to either mentor or to help me out to work together. So the first thing is really the amount of learning. The second thing that really motivates me, and as well, like pretty much everybody that works in this Urban Monks creative cloud, are all these people that are really passionate about quality work. Again, I bring it back to sort of architect company. Like if we were architects, we would build like really amazing apartments, like super nice finishing that really goes into that passion for the detail and for that quality finish, both in terms of client experience, but also in terms of real deliverables to sign off brands that are direct to consumer, super edgy, super digital, and there's always our name behind it. So we really thought it this way. And I think this is what really, really motivates me in the morning. Yeah, so will I live off a yacht and have 300 employees and all of that? I don't think so, because I really want this Urban Monks to stick to the purpose, the original purpose it has. It had to be remote first. So not necessarily linked to one location that I need to be in office. And it has to come to basically also the whole business model. It's not VC backed or not investor backed. Simply to really keep, it's optimized for one thing, which is freedom and independence. This is the core value. So if you're telling me what really keeps me motivated and how do I see myself in 5 years, I just keep on seeing myself free, where that is the vision, where I can really be independent, earn a very decent living, keep on working on exciting projects that make us tick, makes the clients, you know, excited, and keep on building that excitement.
I remind you, this is recorded. So if in 10 years you're off a yacht with 300 employees, I will send you a copy of the recording.
Okay.
Just letting you know. So, you know, I'm going to hold you to it. So, no, I think that's fair. And you've echoed this to me at previous times, and I certainly feel the same way. And I think those are obviously high-class problems to have, but we are both, I think, in that sense, very lucky to be able to be in doing things that we really love and are very passionate about, but also make those choices and being able to keep things, if we need to, small or niche or, and just basic to your point exactly, I feel very strongly about quality being a very important point. So if I'm going to be working with people, the quality has to be very high, and the level of interaction, the quality of the relationship has to be very high. And if not, it's not worth my time or their time, exactly. And I move on.
And that's why, I think we connected really well when we were working together. And that's why I also personally, before even knowing you, I was very connected to the Lighthouse, because you actually feel it when people are deeply fascinated and deeply motivated by that type of quality, that type of boutique, and really, I can't really put like proper labels to it, but there is a vibe that you feel, and sure, you're just excited to, you know, to get more of that.
No, 100%. And that was our target audience. I mean, you know, we were not targeting necessarily people that are just foodies or, you know, creative. We wanted people that would appreciate quality. Even if they are completely unconnected to this physical space, they would appreciate the little touches, as you said. And that could be the menu design. It could be something in the salad. It could be, you know, maybe a little piece of chocolate or that comes with an espresso. Or it could be bigger things. But we felt that there is a community of people that care. And, you know, we found out, honestly, to our pleasant surprise, that that is, in fact, the case. Are they thousands of people? No, but we weren't looking to cater for that. And frankly, even this podcast and other attempts are all about building those interconnections. I mean, 90% of my guests are people I met at the Lighthouse, through the Lighthouse, through other friends there, had a meal with, a coffee, etc., etc. One or two more things, Nelio, before I let you go and celebrate your birthday properly. I'm sure your wife is... It's not, I'm going to have to send her a present, not you. So, I mean, the model you're pursuing, interesting enough, now looks so bang on point. But up until a couple of months ago, pre-COVID, you know, the world wasn't, I mean, some people were, but the norm was not that nomadic existence of no office, connecting with 15 other people, kind of online without very rarely at least being in one physical space. So you have had all these habits that you've developed over the last couple of years that now seem like everybody's doing that. You obviously could not have anticipated what had happened. So what made you make these choices even pre-COVID, where frankly it wasn't as convenient, right? Because people are still used to wanting to see people in person and holding hands. And
yeah, so I started back in 2016. Where basically I realized that I always got targeted, and I got really into this kind of movement called digital nomads, where basically I was targeting constantly on my Facebook feeds back then, where I would see these people working off, I don't know, like really amazing places like Bali and whatever. And I was like, how can these guys can even make a living? So before Karim, actually, let me get back to you. Before Karim, I was in corporate. And in corporate, especially in Paris, like you were extremely, they were very, very strict on what time you were in, what kind of sure. time you had to be out and whatever. Karim gave that more flexibility, which I really loved. And then I found in Digital Nomad, I said, okay, how can I scale that flexibility to an extent where I can still make a living without having to go to an office or having to build an office or whatever that is. And I found these guys, these digital nomads, And I started to realize, how can these guys make a living out of just like having a store on Amazon or a store on Shopify? Or and so after Karim, I decided to take this kind of really this trip to Southeast Asia to start understanding how these digital, to reverse engineer their business models. And that's when I spent like a lot of time in conferences and groups and working spaces to do a sort of cartography of what kind of business models allow these guys to make million-dollar businesses sometimes without a physical location, without employees on the spot, without investors, just out of a laptop 30 meters from a beach. So, and that was fascinating because I said, like, with just this laptop, I could pretty much like, and I can optimize my life for freedom. And this thing made me like it opened the barrier of possibilities after my time in Southeast Asia. And then when I came back here to Dubai to become head of growth as Washman, I really understood, I really leveraged that power of lean, location independent to the next level through different platforms, always like working in different communities and networks. And, you know, and then once I understood the playbook.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Lighthouse Conversations. We're produced by Chirag Desai. You can find all our episodes for free in your favorite podcast player, as well as on our website at thelighthouse.ae/podcast. We'd love to hear from you. You can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or reach out to us on Instagram at thelighthouse_AE. We'll see you in 2 weeks.